From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Living Out Loud with Anna Quinlan. In her syndicated column, Life in the 30s, Quinlan writes about her experiences in her mid-30s as a wife, mother, and working woman. Also today, Musa Mayer reflects on the emotional price of art, the price paid by the artist and the artist's family. She's written a memoir about growing up with her father, the late abstract expressionist painter Philip Guston. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Chuck Willis, the singer who helped put soul music on the map in the 50s. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Question of Who by Yale historian Jonathan Spence. Leonard describes it as a poem about history. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Columnist Anna Quinlan describes herself as a professional observer of her own life. Quinlan writes about being a wife, daughter, and the mother of two with a third on the way. She thinks we undervalue nesting, that we think of it as a 50s kind of thing, what Mrs. Cleaver did when Wally and the Beeve were at school. Quinlan is 35 and calls her column Life in the 30s. This syndicated column originates at the New York Times. Quinlan joined the Times in 1977. She wrote the About New York column and worked as deputy metropolitan editor. Quinlan has been writing her Life in the 30s column since 1986. Her columns are collected in the new book Living Out Loud. The title is a phrase that stuck with her from her early days at the New York Post.
I guess I was about 22 years old, and Pete Hamill had just given up his column in the New York Post. I went to the managing editor of the Post, where I was then working as a reporter, and told him with the kind of chutzpah that I had then that I wanted the column. And he told me that I was a very good writer, but that I wasn't yet mature enough, smart enough, hadn't lived long enough to be qualified for Living Out Loud. And it occurred to me when I was writing the introduction to this book of columns that that, in fact, is what I've been doing for the last 2.5 years. It just seemed like the most apt phrase.
In a way, I think you've become the hero of your own novel, except it's not a novel, it's your real life.
Well, I don't know about the hero part. Hero, protagonist, anti-hero. It depends on whether I'm having a good day or a bad day. But I do think people will say to me sometimes, gee, parts of this book read like fiction. I think the fact is that good fiction reads like good journalism, and that the two have a lot more in common than we usually think.
Describe what you think of as your turf for your column.
Oh, boy. I mean, I have the most free-ranging turf. When Abe Rosenthal, who was then the executive editor, asked me to do the column, he said, write about what you and your friends are talking about on the telephone. And that gave me a lot of leeway, and the fact is it actually has given me a lot of columns, because you do find in your friendship circles that certain issues reassert themselves again and again over a period of time and then die away and are replaced by others. I'd say it's the territory of the small details of life, the small telling details. I'm not a big strokes writer, never have been. I'm not an answers person, never have been. I write a lot about questions and a lot about the little stuff.
Well, all your readers know that you're pregnant now.
I sure am.
with your third. How pregnant are you?
I'm enormous. I mean, just the other night I was getting dressed and my kids were in the room and one of them made a comment about how I looked, and my husband said, that's the kind of thing you usually see in a museum. and I didn't even take offense. I mean, he was right on the money there.
How many months are we talking about?
I'm 7.5 months pregnant, but it seems that each time I do this, I get a little bigger. Jerry says that if we have another child, I'll probably explode about halfway through the process.
Last May, you wrote a column that proved to be very, very controversial in the New York Times. You wrote a column about your decision not to have amniocentesis.
Right.
Would you sum up for us what your reasons were for deciding against that?
Amniocentesis does have some slight risk of miscarriage to a healthy fetus. So it seems to me that there's no point in having it unless, if birth defects are diagnosed, you're prepared to act on that diagnosis. It didn't seem to me to be enough to have amnio to, quote unquote, prepare ourselves for whether we had a baby coming with a problem. And since neither of the things that you find out about, spina bifida or Down syndrome, seem to us to be things that would cause us to want to end the pregnancy, we decided not to have it. We didn't feel that it told us enough about either of those ailments. For example, there's a broad range of problems Down syndrome kids might have. The test doesn't tell you that. They don't say you're going to have a Down syndrome kid who's going to be educable and have no health problems, as opposed to a Down syndrome kid who's going to be profoundly retarded and have serious heart defects or something. So we didn't feel we could get precise enough information. And even with that information, we were unwilling to have an abortion.
You got a huge response. I mean, the Times devoted a lot of letters to your column. What got to you the most from the responses your readers mailed you?
Oh, the we don't like you aspect of it. I mean, there was a lot of I thought I knew you, and I thought I knew the kind of person that you were, and that you were a terrific person, and now I find out that you're a bad person and I don't like you.
Bad in the sense that you made a decision that was different from the writer's decision.
Well, clearly that was it, but it was couched in a lot of different other ways. I mean, people said to me, you're inflicting a lifetime of horrible pain on a child out of your own arrogance. Other people said, you're being accusatory towards women who do have this procedure. People wrote to me who had children with Down syndrome and said it would have been better if we had been able to abort this child in utero. I mean, a wide variety of things which were intensely personal and in some cases very accusatory.
Was this qualitatively different from the responses you got to other articles, because this was a decision so close to you?
That was certainly part of it. And the other thing was that the criticism on the Amnio column was really across the board. Mm-hmm. It was from all different kinds of people. But it did feel very personal. And writing the column was extremely painful for me, because you can't write a column like that without thinking the whole time you're writing it, my God, it might turn out that there's something wrong with this baby. I mean, it crystallized that fear for me in a way. I mean, there definitely was an upside to it. I must say, I was going over some of the mail yesterday, and lots and lots of people sent me photographs and letters about their kids with Downs or with spina bifida. And to see sort of the normalcy of the photographs, you know, we have this kind of monster image of a kid with a birth defect, and here were these perfectly happy, lovely little kids in pictures over and over again, and their mom saying, look, you know, I mean, all of my kids are the lights of my life, and this is no exception.
Yeah. My guest is Anna Quinlan, and she writes the syndicated column Life in the 30s, and her columns, which originated at the New York Times, have just been published in the new book Living Out Loud. So you're about to have your third baby. Now, you've twice gotten through infancy and toilet training, and now you're about to start it all over again.
Right.
How does the balance work out for you, you know, in terms of the independence from having an infant that you've recently won? So you've got, on the one hand, you've got that independence now, and you're going to have to sacrifice that to have another baby. On the other hand, you're going to have another baby in the house, you know, which I'm sure you're very, very excited about.
Right.
But what's that check and balance column like for you in your mind now?
Well, I think I fall much more on the side of the kind of person who likes having babies around. I mean, it did occur to me at a certain point this summer that I was going to have about a 4-month window of opportunity where I would not have to purchase diapers. And that was pretty exciting, I must admit. And then I thought, I've blown it. In November, I'm going to have to do this all over again. But I have had a tendency, and I've talked to a lot of women who have this tendency too. As soon as my kids start to get out of the baby phase, I start to think about having another one.
Mm-hmm.
It's something about that kind of dependency and that kind of touchy-feely thing that you have with an infant that just lures me. I mean, my kids are 17 months apart, and one of the reasons they are, which has actually worked out very positively for us and for them, is because as soon as Quinn started to act a little bit like he wasn't a baby anymore. I just produced another one. and in fact, probably would have done it again when Christopher started to pull away, had my husband, you know, who is a wonderful person but can only take so much, said, could we take maybe like a year off where you're not actually nursing? And I said, well, that's a reasonable request.
In one of your columns, you described that you used to be an overachiever, very absorbed in success and in competitiveness.
Right.
Did you change?
Yes, I changed a great deal. I don't know whether I would have become a nicer person anyhow, but it just seemed to me that as I got older, that a lot of that grab for the brass ring was sort of specious, that a lot of the people who were making the grab successfully were people that I didn't particularly like, and that what was important was being able to do what I did well. And I really felt that I did, and that that I didn't need a certain amount of compensation or a certain amount of recognition within the office to validate that.
You know, in one of your columns, you quoted Paul Tsongas, who, after he stepped down from the Senate,
right,
when he had cancer, he said, "No one on his deathbed ever said, 'I wish I had spent more time on my business.'"
Right.
And you know, I remember when he said that, and I remember thinking, even then, I bet that's not true. That I bet there's a lot of people who look back at their lives and said, I wish I had been able to give more time to my work. I wish I'd been able to write that novel, paint that painting, become a baseball player or whatever, fulfill that ambition, and not have to spend all my time caring for others.
Well, I certainly think there are people who say, I wish I had realized the professional dream that I didn't realize. But my experience has been that more often than not, people, especially workaholics, regret some of the amount of time that they put into their professional ambition, and really realize that that a lot of what they missed was being close to their families. I, for example, find the regret factor in terms of looking back at their life much higher among a lot of men I know than I do among a lot of women. Even when the women had professional ambitions which didn't even come close to being fulfilled. Maybe that's because women tend to invest themselves a lot more in the emotional content of their lives anyhow, and are able to say happily, well, my kids are real well adjusted and they've made happy marriages and become happy people. But I do think that a lot of people regret having been workaholics at certain stages of their lives, and I certainly would regret having done it now.
Well, I think of how lucky you are in a way, because you can combine, job and family so easily, since the subject of so many of your columns is your family, you can do a lot of your writing at home.
The luckiest. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's. I did that piece where I mentioned the Tsongas quote about the slaking off of ambition and about working part time, and I got a letter from a woman who said, "Please spare me another piece about how easy it is for writers to combine home and work." And all I could say was, "Yes. That's absolutely true. There's one or two professions where you can play the angles during the years that your kids are small, and this is definitely one of them."
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your column and about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Anna Quinlan is my guest. She writes a syndicated column called Life in the 30s. She's in her mid-30s, and the column originates at the New York Times, and her columns have been collected in a new book called Living Out Loud. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Syndicated columnist Anna Quinlan is my guest. You demolished the notion of quality time in one of your columns. So I want to talk with you a little bit about that. You went through all the reasons why you think the notion of putting aside quality time to spend with your child is a really absurd concept. Would you sum up for us?
I think demolished might be too strong a word, but it just seems to me that it takes two to tangle in that way, and it takes two to have quality time. And lots of times when you set up this artificial little, okay, we're going to have 2 hours where we're really going to connect, the chances are excellent that your kid won't be up for it. I mean, kids find their own time to work in meaningful dialogue with you or to connect with you on various levels, and sometimes they happen to be on a different time frame than yours. The other thing is that working parents tend to schedule in quality time at the end of the day, when in my experience, everybody is tired and crabby. Actually, a friend of my younger sister's, who's an elementary school teacher, wrote me a letter about that column, which was very funny, where she said that she has a lot of kids in a private school who are the children of 2 career parents, very directed, very ambitious parents, and that some mornings they will look around in the classroom and 3 or 4 of the kids will be half asleep at the switch, and the teachers will look at each other and nod and say, oh, they had a quality time night last night. and what that means is that somebody scheduled in dinner and maybe, you know, a showing of Cinderella or whatever. And meantime, these kids are all crabbed out because they didn't get to bed on time.
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, this is what I was talking about.
Well, I like the way you describe that this idea of quality time rules out the idea of regular life being lived together.
Right.
You describe how you and your husband went through a period of time where you only got to see each other on weekends.
Right.
I guess you had a commute to see each other. And when you'd get to see each other, there was no sitting across the room from each other, no each of you individually reading a book or going about your work. Every moment had to count because you wouldn't be together until the following weekend. So there
Right.
was no quote, real life.
And there were no fights. You couldn't allow yourself to fight, which, of course, is a major part of real life, because, of course, you only had this little bit of precious time together. So it had to be not only quality time, it had to be positive quality time. It was very artificial. And I think you always see that fail when you set that up with your kids. I mean, every time I decide I'm going to have a heart-to-heart with one of my kids. I mean, I wanted to have a heart-to-heart with the younger one the other day because one of his friends said he'd been hitting him in school. So I tried to sit him down and have a real, like, direct conversation about whether Christopher was hitting Eli in school. And I kept getting all this stuff about what had happened on Alice in Wonderland on the tape and, you know, how they read The Cat in the Hat and so on and so forth. And, you know, this morning walking to school in his own good time, Christopher said, I'm not hitting Eli anymore. So that was the second half of that dialogue about 4 days after it was begun by the parent.
My guess is Anna Quinlan. Now, Quinlan is your maiden name.
Quinlan
Quote,
is my
I
name.
Mean, maiden
it's my
it's
name.
Your name. It's
yes.
your name. You never changed your name to your husband's name.
No.
Nor did you become a hyphenate. Your children have your husband's name, which makes you the only person in your immediate family, in your nuclear family, that has the name of Quinlan.
Except that my eldest son's first name is Quinlan.
Right.
Right.
Right. Quinn for short.
Right.
So how come you decided to not only keep your name, but not become a hyphenate?
You know, I never decided it. I've got to say, it never crossed my mind to change my name. I remember, okay, boy, it's amazing. I told my husband this on our first date. I told him that if I ever got married, I would never change my name. And he suggested that there wasn't much chance of that. So after having heard me come out with this, it just seemed to me that if they didn't change theirs, why should we change ours? And the other thing was that, you know, I'd been a writer since I was a little girl, and it seemed to me that every word had a meaning and that I was a distinct thing and that the name for that thing was Anna Quinlan. And it seemed to me a little bit like, you know, changing the name for water to something else. I did not think through, I don't think at the time, the fact that eventually I was going to have this entire family who were all going to be Crovatans. And I must say I found it a little odd when my first child was born to look at him and think he's not a Quinlan.
Have you ever had second thoughts about it, but not hyphenating your name?
No.
That's interesting.
No, I've never. I mean, I'm perfectly comfortable with being Anna Quinlan, and I think my husband's perfectly comfortable with it, too.
Which means that you'll have no trouble explaining it to the kids.
No, I mean, and we've talked about it. You know, it's real easy to explain it to kids by saying Daddy and I had different parents.
Right.
I mean, they, you know, my father's last name is Quinlan and Daddy's father's last name was Crovaton. And, oh, okay, now I understand. They do come up against parents of friends of theirs who have the same last name, and that's why the issue's been raised. But it really has been kind of a non-issue for them, especially for the eldest, who thinks this is perfectly normal because his first name is Quinlan.
Right. Anna Quinlan is my guest, and she writes the nationally syndicated column Life in the 30s. It originates at the New York Times, and her columns are collected in a new book called Living Out Loud. Earlier on, you were explaining that your editor said to you, write about the kinds of things you talk to your friends about on the telephone. Well, I know a lot of times what I end up talking about with my friends on the telephone is how frustrating it is that we don't have more time to talk with each other on the telephone. And I wonder if you find in your life that you don't have enough time for the friends that you want to see, especially for women friends that you want to see.
I definitely don't have enough time for the friends that I want to see, although we always make time to talk to each other. I mean, it's sort of a touchstone. I'd say between 9 and 10 or 10:30 most mornings, since most of my friends are journalists who don't start to chug along until close to noon, we usually all check in with each other. I think the thing that we find most clearly is, you know, every couple months I'll say to my husband, well, you know, I met this woman, so-and-so, and she really wants to be friends with me, but I don't have time to have any more friends. I mean, it sounds terrible because there was... you realize that up until a certain stage in your life, you kept making new friends and solidifying them. So certain of my friends have been very close to me since high school or college, and others have been close to me maybe for the last 10 years. But that maybe in the last five, you've become friendly acquaintances with people, but they haven't really solidified into those bedrock friendships because you just haven't had time. And that's something that I really regret.
Have you figured out the way to say to someone who you'd like to be friends with but don't have the time to, I'd love to be your friend, but let's give up on it right now?
No.
I mean, how do you handle it?
No, what happens is that we tend to see each other maybe once or twice a year at lunch and say, I'll call you and we'll get together some weekend, and it just never happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a sad fact of modern life, but I mean, especially with the kids and everything. I mean, I sometimes feel that way about my marriage too. We sometimes feel with the two small kids and another on the way that at a certain point we at least tacitly must have said to each other, I'll see you in about 5 years. We'll meet on St. Bart's and we'll stay there for 2 weeks and you know, everything will be copacetic.
When you first wanted to be a columnist when you were 22, you were telling us, you know, that your editor said you're too young to start living out loud.
Right.
Do you believe that now, that people in their 20s are too young to, or in their early 20s especially, are too young to be columnists? Now that you're in your mid-30s and are a columnist.
I hate to generalize, but I think the answer is probably yes. I mean, I think of my 20s as the time when I made the most mistakes, sort of publicly, in terms of turning into a real person, and said the most things that I regret. I mean, when I was a teenager, I didn't have enough moxie to present myself that way. But when I was in my 20s, all through my 20s, I was working as a reporter at the New York Times. And boy, it's a real public place to fail and a real bad place to grow up because of that. And I just was a little too rough around the edges. That was a time when I thought I had a lot of answers and a lot of opinions, as opposed to what I have now, which are mainly doubts.
And stories, personal stories.
Yeah. Yeah, that too. And I was still working through a lot of things then. I mean, there's no way that I could have written with any kind of equanimity about either my relationship with my husband or the death of my mother or my relationship with my father when I was in my 20s. I just didn't know where I was at.
You started off covering other people's stories, working as a reporter. Now you're mostly covering your own stories. Does covering a beat that basically comes down to you and your family ever make you want to go out again and find other people's stories to write about?
The press of news makes me want to find other people's stories to write about. I mean, when a good story breaks, I get so itchy, I can barely sit still. I mean, all during the Tawana Brawley thing, I kept saying, what am I doing here in this little house writing this little column? When the shuttle Challenger blew up 2.5 years ago, I was sitting in a chair nursing, and I think watching The Young and the Restless, and I just thought, this is the craziest thing. I mean, this is my life, and it's just passing before me as though I was a civilian. This column doesn't make me want to do it so much. This column is doing it. It's amazing to me how much of doing this column is using the skills I picked up as a reporter. It's just that I don't have a notebook. I'm reading the quotes off of my mind is what it comes down to.
How long do you think you want to keep it up?
Well, I can tell you exactly.
Okay.
the last column is either going to run on November 24th, which is Thanksgiving, or December 1st, depending on what day this baby's born.
And then you're going to give it up for good or just take a break?
No, I'm going to give it up for good.
No kidding. How come?
The only way you can read the column is if you buy the book.
why are you giving it up?
I never work for 6 months after one of my kids is born. I mean, I've made that a policy. For 6 months after the other two, I didn't work at all. And I intended to do the same with this one. But also, I think columnists tend to outstay their welcome. And especially this kind of column, you don't want to be writing the second string columns. I mean, my idea of professional hell is to be sitting in a restaurant and hear people talking about how good Anna Quinlan used to be, like a year or two ago when she was still fresh. And so I'm going to get while the getting's good.
And what are you going to do afterwards?
Got me. I mean, I have a novel coming out probably next year from Random House, which needs a little fine-tuning, but is more or less at the end of its long road. And I have this television show that's going to be based on the collection of columns. Lorimar optioned the book, and CBS has bought the program, and it apparently is going to become a real thing.
Oh, someone's going to play you?
Well,
someone's going to play someone based on
contractually,
you.
The Anna Quinlan character cannot be called Anna Quinlan. and the two little boys may become girls for all I know, but it's going to be sort of grounded in a lot of the issues and the situations that come up in the columns. Yeah.
All right. Well, that should be fun. Anna Quinlan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Anna Quinlan, who writes the Life in the 30s column. It's nationally syndicated, originates in the New York Times, and apparently ends sometime in November or December. In the meantime, if you'd like to read her columns, they are collected in a new book called Living Out Loud, and that is published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film director John Schlesinger. His many films include Midnight Cowboy, Marathon Man, and The Falcon and the Snowman. His new movie, Madame Suzatska, stars Shirley MacLaine as a controversial piano teacher in London. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Musa Mayer knew her father was a brilliant painter, but as she grew up, she felt eclipsed by his talents and shut out of his world. Her father was the late abstract expressionist painter Philip Guston. In her new memoir, Mayer rediscovers Guston as a parent and artist. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles soul singer Chuck Willis. He was a star for Atlantic Records in the 50s. Ed tells how he also became King of the Stroll. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Question of Who by Yale historian Jonathan Spence. Leonard says Spence brings the eyes and ears of a novelist to history. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Mitaleshwar Singh is enjoying his first taste of freedom in 21 months. The Indian-born U.S. resident is on his way to West Germany following his release yesterday by Lebanese kidnappers. Earlier today in Damascus, the 60-year-old educator told reporters he was well-treated by his Muslim captors. 15 foreigners, including 9 Americans, are still being held in Lebanon by a number of groups. Although Singh's release raises new hopes for their freedom, the BBC's Tim Fluellen reports that serious complications are likely to intervene.
First, Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine is, though pro-Iranian, almost certainly quite separate from the group or groups holding the other hostages, including Terry Waite. These organizations are thought to be less susceptible to Syrian pressure than was Jihad for Palestine. Secondly, though Britain's and the United States' relationships with Iran are improving by leaps and bounds when compared with just a few months ago, it could well be that Iran will not try too hard to have their supporters spring the hostages until it sees more clearly where renewed and closer ties with the West will lead. Sheikh Fadlallah, the Beirut spiritual leader of the Shiite Muslims, from whose ranks most of the kidnappers come, said yesterday that releases of the Western hostages were unlikely until after the American presidential elections. And that's a view few would seriously dispute at this stage.
Tim Fluellen reporting from Nicosia. About 350 anti-abortion demonstrators were arrested today in Atlanta. They were dragged away from 3 abortion clinics being blocked as part of a protest that organizers are calling the Siege of Atlanta. The anti-abortion group Operation Rescue has vowed that the protest will continue all week at the city's 7 abortion clinics. The series of protests had been expected, and pro-choice groups say they will not stage counter-demonstrations. George Bush today proposed a program to enlist volunteers to help the needy. Campaigning in Sacramento, California, Bush says he wants to spend $100 million federal dollars on the program. The federal funds would be set up as a matching program to generate the same amount in private donations.
I want our affluent to help our poor, and I want our young to help our elderly by involving them in the needs of Americans. And I want the young men and women of our tree-lined suburbs to get on a bus or the subway or the metro and go into the cities where the want is. And I want this movement to become part of the people's lives.
Michael Dukakis questioned the vice president's ability to keep his promises. Campaigning in Evanston, Illinois, Dukakis said Bush has not shown the strength it takes to be an effective leader.
If George Bush couldn't stand up to the Ayatollah, he couldn't stand up to Noriega, he couldn't stand up to Japan, he couldn't stand up to the special interests, why should anyone believe that he'll stand up for the economic future of this country?
Dukakis said Bush's campaign has stooped to the tactics of Richard Nixon by accusing the Massachusetts governor of downgrading America when he points to the country's weakness on the international economic front. The 5 Discovery astronauts took the day off today after their successful 4-day mission in space. Tomorrow, they begin a week of debriefings on the first shuttle flight since the Challenger disaster 32 months ago. Discovery's boosters were recovered from the sea and are being disassembled at Cape Canaveral. NASA says that preliminary checks have shown no signs of leaks or failures. The U.S. Navy today said an anti-submarine helicopter disappeared in the Pacific during night maneuvers 80 miles from San Diego. The 4 crewmen on board the helicopter are presumed dead. On Wall Street, stock prices closed slightly lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 3 points to close at 2102.06. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rhythm and blues singer Chuck Willis had the kind of talent that could have kept him a star a lot longer than he was. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of Willis's career.
Nobody cares. Nobody knows. I'm going to tell you just how my story goes.
Chuck Willis recorded My Story in 1952, and it took him to the tops of the rhythm and blues charts, which is where he would live off and on for the next 6 years. To anyone who's followed the history of rock and roll, Chuck Willis is indeed an important figure. Like Ray Charles, he was among the first to take the feel of gospel music and the vocabulary of the blues and turn it into something that would one day become known as soul. He was a transitional figure between the big band singer and the kind of singer who'd stand in front of a small combo. But what was his story, anyway? We know that he was born in Atlanta in 1928, and that before he was out of his teens, he was performing in the black nightclubs there. Zenas Daddy Sears, a white disc jockey who was in love with black music, discovered Chuck and got him a contract with OK Records. From the very first session, it was apparent that Chuck Willis was a very big talent and a very disturbed one.
Well, I tried. I tried hard to get along with you. You know I tried. I tried hard to get along with you.
I Tried wasn't a hit, unsurprisingly enough. But My Story, a year later, was, and Willis began to tour. When he wasn't on the road, he'd hole up in his house in Atlanta and write songs. The best, like the classic Feel So Bad, he saved for himself.
Feel so bad, feel like a ball game on a rainy day. Feel so bad, feel like a ball game on a rainy day. Yes, I got my rain check. Shake my head and walk away.
But as the decade wore on, Willis's own career wasn't getting anywhere. In 1956, help came in the form of Jerry Wexler, one of the partners in Atlantic, America's preeminent rhythm and blues label, the people who'd put Ray Charles on top. Willis had already written lots of solid material for Atlantic artists like Ruth Brown, so Wexler bet that Atlantic could make him into a star. Willis was into the idea. He started wearing a turban on stage at the suggestion of his pal Screamin' Jay Hawkins, who knew a thing or two about flamboyant stagecraft. So he went into the studio with the best band Atlantic could put together, and right from the start, he was making classics.
It's too late, she's gone.
Too late, too late.
It's too late, my.
Too Late was a huge summertime hit in 1956, and Wexler told Chuck he could do whatever he wanted to. And what he wanted to do was something very odd. I want to do an old standard, he told Wexler. I thought he was going to do something like I'm in the Mood for Love, Wexler said later, but this was his standard. C.C. Rider had first been recorded by Ma Rainey in the 20s, but it was older than that. And for a follow-up, he went back to another ancient black folk song.
Gather round me, everybody. I'm going to tell you a story about Betty and Dupree.
Thank you. Now the story really gets weird. Dick Clark decided that Betty and Dupree was the perfect record to launch the dance craze, The Stroll. And suddenly, Chuck Willis was on television demonstrating this dance and being crowned king of The Stroll, even though he'd had to learn it from Clark's staff. He was anxious to record some more, though, and wouldn't tour until at least two more songs were in the can. One was very much the old Chuck.
What am I living for, if not for you? What am I living for, if not for you? What am I living for, if not for you? Oh, nobody else will do.
The other song was to cash in on his new reputation as a teen idol.
My mama told me she didn't like that rock and roll. I said, please, mama, please. Mama, you just don't know I don't want
But Chuck Willis had a secret. Despite the fact that he was a Muslim, he was also a secret drinker. He developed an ulcer and refused to have it treated. It wasn't until April 10, 1958, that friends convinced him to enter an Atlanta hospital, and when the doctor operated, he saw it was too late. As disc jockeys across America happily applied the needle to their new copies of What Am I Living For, Chuck Willis lay dead, barely 30 years old.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. When Musa Mayer was growing up, people would always say, "You're so lucky to be the daughter of a famous artist." But for Mayer, it was a mixed blessing. She loved and appreciated her father's work, but his obsession with painting left him little time for her. Mayer's father, the late Philip Guston, was a major figure among the abstract expressionists of the 1950s. The Museum of Modern Art is currently re-examining Guston's work in a retrospective of his drawings. Mayer has re-examined her relationship with her father in her memoir, Night Studio. Writing the book helped her learn more about her father after his death in 1980.
I suppose it was important to me because I grew up so much in awe of my father and so much, in a sense, eclipsed by him. And I felt very needful of a creative life myself, but very insecure about being able to produce anything of any value. I was so painfully aware of my father's genius that it was always very difficult for me to affirm anything that I myself was able to do.
Your father was a very intense man, very emotionally involved in his work, and I'm sure this created a great deal of severe mood swings. If the work was going well, that he'd feel very good, but if the work was going poorly, a terrible despair would fall over him.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect you and your mother? Did you feel that you would catch his moods?
Well, as a child, I suppose I felt rather helpless and sometimes frightened by his mood swings. As an adult, I think I coped with it in an interesting way. I became involved with psychology and got a degree as a counselor and worked as a therapist for about 10 years or so. And often later in life, I would find myself in the position of being my father's confidant. I won't say his therapist because it certainly wasn't that, but in some ways, I think that I entered that field as a way of understanding and coming to terms with my father's mood swings, as you say, his anguish and despair. And I, for years, had a fantasy of, in a sense, making him better and making him more available to me.
You quote something that John Cage had said to your father once. I think this is a great quote. Cage said, when you start working, everybody's in your studio. The past, your friends, enemies, the art world, and above all, your own ideas. But as you continue, they start leaving one by one, and you're left completely alone. Then if you're lucky, even you leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a need that you recognize.
Oh,
in your father, to be alone in the studio.
Absolutely. That need to isolate oneself. Well, I feel it too in my own work. I've always mm-hmm. been a solitary person, and certainly for somebody who is as extraordinarily sensitive as he was, he needed to have a sanctuary, so to speak, a place that he could work alone. There's a wonderful story he told about as a boy hiding in a closet and painting by the light of a single light bulb, doing his very first work that way, and of his mother and father's family coming over for, you know, the Sunday afternoon chicken dinner, and everybody would ask, well, where is Philip? And he had instructed his mother to lie, essentially, and say that he was away with friends while all the time he was working secluded in this closet. And for him, and the symbol of that closet appears in a number of his later paintings, the hanging light bulb and so on. The need for private, personal, inviolable space, and the possibility of in that space being able to transcend oneself, which I truly believe that he did, despite all the feelings of deprivation and so on that I report in my book. I am absolutely convinced that whatever the cost, my father was really able to do some of the greatest paintings of this century. There's no question in my mind about that.
How close were you with your father at the time of his death in 1980?
I felt very close with him at that time. We didn't have very much contact, but about a year before he died, he had had a very severe heart attack that nearly killed him. And I spent a couple of weeks with him at that time, just being there with him in the hospital and trying to help out as best I could. And I had, I think by that time, gotten over most of my anger at him and my resentment. All of my life, really, since I had left home as a child, I had been, in a sense, excluded from my parents' lives. I was given very clear messages that part of their lives was over and they needed privacy and space and time. And so I wasn't able to be with him as much as I would have liked.
After your father's death, you felt, I think, kind of jealous of biographers and art critics who seemed to know almost more about him than you did. And in a way, it's from that angle that you've approached your father in the mm-hmm. past few years. You put together a catalog of his works.
Yes.
You've studied his works very carefully. Has approaching your father as an artist instead of as a father given you new insights into him?
Well, that's what came first, approaching him as an artist, because that's what was accessible to me. That was sort of the layer on the top. But then after a few years of cataloging his work, I started becoming interested in my own motivations for doing so and my continued involvement with that project. And I realized that there were forces within me that were wanting to know much more, wanting to know my father, the person, wanting to know things about his family that he had never told me. And I, in a way, approached it as a biographer. I went and interviewed people. I went back to Los Angeles and met the surviving members of his family and spoke with them and look through old photographs, and as much as I could, I talked with all of his friends over the years and tried to get them to paint as intimate a portrait of the man that they knew. And I found that that's really what I had been looking for, was who he was as a person, because that's what had been most inaccessible to me.
And you feel you have that now?
I have it, I think, as much as it's possible to have, yeah.
Are you living with his paintings? Do you have a lot of his paintings or drawings in your house?
Yes.
Can I ask you if there's one that has an especially a special position of prominence in your house that you could describe for us and tell us what it means to you personally?
Well, there's a painting that I've had with me in one form or another for a good part of my life. It's a painting called Sanctuary. My father did it in the mid-40s, and it's a portrait of one of his students. It's a reclining figure of a man. It was done in Iowa City, and it's a very dreamy, melancholy painting where he is sort of staring in reverie off in the distance, and there's the city of Iowa City in the background where I was born. And it has a special meaning for me. It's now above the desk where I work.
And the meaning for you it has?
I guess it symbolizes the quality of creative contemplation that I think of as being so characteristic of my father. There's a wonderful Durer, famous Durer etching called Melancholia, which he always had hanging in his kitchen, which is a figure of an angel really contemplating. It's a very complicated piece, but it's a contemplative piece that talks about, I suppose you'd have to say, the cost of art in relation to life. It's a very private thing and a very it's difficult for me to articulate. I realize. Yeah.
I like what you just said, though, the cost of art in relation to life.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's finally what your book is about, I think.
Yes, I think so, too. That need to withdraw into that very inner private space to the sources of one's own creativity, and what a very ultimately sad withdrawal that turns out to be, however worthwhile it is. It does, I think, have costs.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Musa Mayer's memoir of her father, Philip Guston, is titled Night Studio, and it's published by Knopf. An exhibit of Philip Guston's drawings is on view at the Museum of Modern Art in New York until November 1st. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, on day two of a hostage release, the U.S. Is saying that it has no idea why one hostage was released in Beirut yesterday after being held hostage for 20 months. U.S. officials did insist that there were no negotiations, no deals, and no quid pro quo. Also on the campaign trail in California, George Bush has proposed a $200 million program to encourage teenagers to volunteer their services for community work. And at Northwestern University in Illinois, Michael Dukakis wasn't talking programs, he was talking personalities. He compared George Bush to Richard Nixon.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Historian Jonathan Spence tries to bring the past to life by writing about it in an almost novelistic style. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Spence's latest work, The Question of Who. Hu, spelled H-U, was a Chinese man who lived in the 1700s and suffered a miserable fate when he was taken from his homeland.
They come with whips. I quote from Yale historian Jonathan Spence. Something, the waiting coach, the bright light, the expressions on their faces, terrifies Hu. He slashes out with his fingers at Cardinale's face. Cardinale jumps back, but Hu catches his shirt and rips it right down the front. Baines is hitting at Hu with his whip. Cardinale does the same, and with the help of Baines' friend, they drag Hu toward the carriage. Hu throws himself down to the ground to prevent them taking him further, and a curious crowd of Parisians begins to gather. Cardinale forces back the onlookers, while Baines and his friend drag Hu into their carriage and throw themselves inside with him. They pull on a pair of manacles over Hu's wrists and lock them shut. Thus, in April 1723, John Hu, a Chinese handyman and bookkeeper, brought back like a trophy from the Orient by a Jesuit priest, is hauled off to the insane asylum at Charenton. Hu has been a disappointment to Father Fouquet from the beginning of their journey by slow boat from Canton, seasick, afraid of pirates, tormented by visions. Landfall is even worse. Who jumps from moving carriages to hide in hedgerows and look at windmills. He steals a horse, and they call him Quixote. He wants to walk across all of France, beating on a drum he's made himself, and begging. He refuses to assist at mass because women are around, and he hops like a lunatic over the cruciform tiles on the parquet floors of the Jesuit church so as not to step on a cross. And he's spooked in Paris by the prostitutes on the streets and the embalmed heads of bygone Louis in the cathedrals. Fouquet, who must be off to see the Pope to convince him that the ancient Chinese texts secretly concern themselves with Christian mysteries, leaves Hu behind in the hands of the police, who send him to the same asylum Marat will end up in after the revolution, which didn't happen soon enough for Hu. There really was a Hu and a Fouquet, and all this really happened in the 1720s, as everything always happened in Jonathan Spence's strange and wonderful books, like The Death of Woman Wang, or The Gate of Heavenly Peace, or The Memory Palace of Matteo Ricci. It's just that Spence brings to the scholarly archives the eyes and ears of a novelist and an anthropologist, and the stories he tells are somehow dreamlike, glazed like miniatures from the Italian Renaissance, out of a time beyond imagining and a space that curves away from us. The Jesuit went to China and saw only what he'd brought with him. A Chinese came the other way, and God and France drove him mad. Or was the Jesuit himself insane? And who's begging a petition? His beating on the drum a cry for help? His seizures his only defense against that windmill, the spinning crucifix? After 2 years, they let him go because nobody was paying for his keep. He was forcibly returned to China. I wonder, back home, what he told them. So does Spence in this poem about history.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Question of Hu by Jonathan Spence. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, America's best-known baby expert, Dr. Benjamin Spock, reflects on his own upbringing. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new albums by flutist James Galway. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.